good that we have got a good turnaround on this. Although I feel like a quick turnaround was to be expected, given the last one that we read and the one that was coming after it. I feel like it was to be expected for us to want to leave that one in the dust and get quickly to this, like, Rachel book.
Rachel Palette
Cleanse. Oh, it's so good. Which I noticed you tweeted that you were really excited about talking about this and that you loved this one a lot, so that made me excited also.
I did tweet that, and I do still love this book, although it doesn't contain as much internal affairs as I recall, which is not its fault, and obviously we got plenty of that in Visser, because that's all Visser is the Earths auditing each other, actually like office drama, and the Garaton Inspector is an interesting character, so.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's, again, part of the idea of, like, Animorphs grounding sci-fi and supernatural and, like, wacky premises with, like, realistic drama. Part of it is sort of the human element and the psychological element, but another part of it is of the mundane that, like, at a certain point, you know, 37 books in, the Visser has to be audited for his performance in trying to take over the planet Earth because it hasn't happened yet.
Seriously, you get the feeling that his superiors, the Council of 13, are just, like, sitting up on their spaceship or whatever, just, like, tapping their wrists, going, come on, dude, like, why is this taking so long? We were supposed to have an entire planet of host species, like, 2 months ago. It's a completely planned schedule. Your whole budget. You know, it's like Yerkes, Parks, and Rec, which I would totally watch.
Yeah. Yeah, seconded, co-signed. The idea of, like, yeah, the banality of bureaucracy for something so insidious and evil as, like, a Yerk Empire. And that they even...
Still has to do the paperwork.
Exactly. And, well, at one point at the end, Rachel even sort of says, like, ugh, like, politics. I think it's Rachel. It may be somebody else. But, yeah, the idea that, like, that it's not just, you know, evil villains. And that's another thing we've talked about also is that the Visser 3 is definitely scary and sinister and evil, but also he's, like, petty and, like, ineffectual sometimes and, like, arrogant, and that those things make him a fleshed-out villain.
He looks like a glamorous, like, you know, scary mega-villain, but I do get the sense now, you know, having a little more nuanced reading comprehension that a lot of his, like, appeal, per se, is that he has an Andalite host body. Like, he was the Yerk who was able to infest an Andalite, and that, he's, like, been riding that ever since. He's not particularly good at his job. He's that dude that you read about in Ask Your Manager, and you're like, how's he not getting fired? He's got somebody in the basement, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
In this case, you know, he's got an Andalite.
Yeah, no, that is a very good point. And this book was the book, if he were ever going to get fired, it would be in this book, because the premise of this book, as Diana has referenced, is that an inspector comes to pay Visser 3 a visit because his, you know, effectiveness has been called into question, and they've sent not only a Yerk from the Council of 13, yes, he's on the council?
He's...
Or hired.
This is a dramatic bone that I liked, is that he wants to be on the Council of 13. Like, he's trying to get promoted, and you get the sense that, oh, he's trying to get promoted by taking Visser 3 down, by showing the Council of 13 that he's really bad at his job, that somebody can do his job better, probably.
This
I'm
guy.
Myself here. And that, yeah, they're in a little bit of, like, a little war of... A bureaucratic war, similar to the way that Visser 1 and Visser 3 were in Visser.
Which is a delight. That it's all, I feel like that's always one of our favorite things.
They're really petty. They're both just, like, really snippy to each other, and the Animorphs are just like, these bitches. Y'all obviously don't need us, right? So we're just gonna, yeah.
And, well, and so it also changes the, it muddies the water a little bit. I don't think that's a very apt metaphor, but it sort of shifts Visser 3's priorities. And I feel like so many villains, in that they're villains, the ultimate goal is always, like, I'm gonna conquer this planet, like, get all the glory, and it's going to be, and it's very, like, straightforward in that way. Whereas at the end of this book, because of the interaction with him and the Garatron, and the inspector, and the idea that the inspector is vying for, like, a promotion by ruining Visser 3, that, like, Visser 3, in a weird way, almost sides with the Animorphs to take down the Garatron. And so, it's similar to, I guess, how the Animorphs teamed up with Visser 1 at one point. It's sort of this idea of a shifting alliance, and that villains' priorities can change in really ridiculous, petty ways sometimes, but it adds depth and texture, and also, again, prolongs the story for over, you know, however many book installments.
Something I enjoyed about, I mean, obviously we've seen people on the Yerk side going up against Visser 3, you know, in terms of, like, infighting before, but the Inspector is basically a souped-up version of Visser 3, like, in every way. He's at least as ambitious. You know, he's trying to get this promotion, he wants to be a counselor, which would give him power, as I understand the Council of 13, over the Vissers. And even his host, is this like, super analyte. So it's like he did, you know, he almost did the thing that Visser 3 did by infesting this this species that there's only, you know, there's only one ant-like controller. The Garatron is, you know, it's got the four legs, it's got the blue fur.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens to be really, really fast.
Yeah, that's another good detail, I think.
So,
like,
you're seeing him and going, huh, he's like Visser 3 on speed, both in terms of ambition and in terms of his physical being, and definitely in terms of pettiness, because he's so petty.
Yeah. No, that's a good point about just, like, little details that add to the drama and sort of conflict and just general enjoyment of this book.
And then on the Visser side, like, after their initial conversation, like, the key details is that the Inspector was given this morph.
Body.
He was given this host.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't, like, steal it the way that, obviously, Alarin is a slave. I mean, the Garatron, we're not given a lot of information about the species. So, they're, you know, presumably they're also enslaved. But the implication is, like, the Inspector's kind of a weenie. Like, he works his way up the corporate ladder, like, the old-fashioned way by, like, you know, by back-patting and glad handing, and
yeah.
Somebody gave him a really cool host.
Yeah.
And so Visser 3's like, yeah, God, you're awful. Like,
yeah.
You took your time. It's so dramatic.
That is another really good point. And well, and like the Garatron are like a new, like,
yeah, they're like
host.
A fancy new sports car species.
Yeah, but it's also, they're widespread. So, like, Visser 3 still can keep, like, the chip on his shoulder about being, like, the only Andalite, which I think that, like, intensifies, because it is the one thing that he has going for him that this Inspector does not, and that, like, that Visser 3 can, like, still claim, like, special status over this Inspector, especially with the idea that the Inspector, like, went, like, the conventional route to power.
It's very weird to hear Yerk be like, I want a promotion. Like, what? You want a promotion? And then you remember, yeah, actually, they call themselves the Yerk Empire, but to my knowledge, there's not an emperor. Like, there's a bunch of bureaucrats who make decisions, like, pretty much every society on Earth.
That is a very good point. We don't know.
And so this is, like, glamour, this glamorous terror of, like, the Yerk Empire, like, no, it's just a bunch of dudes who, like, you know, want to get promoted.
It's still just,
who,
like,
want the corner office.
Yeah, like, water cooler culture. Like, corporate,
yes,
finality.
City, backbitey. Oh, I'm, you know, I deserve this, and here's why, and you're really bad at your job, and you don't deserve it, and, like, God, this is too relatable.
Yeah, well, and it also sort of fleshes out the idea that, you know, we've all endlessly talked about the fact that, like, some Yerks, like, don't buy into it. Like, some Yerks are not all about the Empire or, you know, even having a host kind of thing. Like, they just want to live their lives. And I feel like that is another nice layer of sort of the, like, a very common or understandable, like, disconnect from bureaucracy and the idea that what's going on with the Council of 13 and, like, those politics of the upper echelon are not necessarily going to affect, you know, any Yerk that you just pluck out of the Yerk pool.
Yeah, they probably didn't vote in the last election.
Probably not. Voter turnout is real low for the Yurks. This book was definitely, not only was the Yurk side of this really interesting and fleshed out, but the Animorph side of this was also really, like, this is kind of the best of what makes both sides, like, really great. The idea of, you know, three-dimensional villains and power struggles and stuff like that on the Yurk side, and then on the Animorph side, like, character interaction and trying to make decisions as a group in special circumstances and not having the right answer, not being able to know if you're doing the right thing, like the challenge of leadership when the stakes are so high. And I think the challenge also of being friends and also and having personal relationships with these people that are essentially teammates. Or even coworkers in some ways, like they have to work together, but a lot of the interactions are shaded by like personal alliances, and especially in Rachel's eyes, because Rachel is not an objective person in any way. So
yeah, her interactions with Tobias in this book were really interesting.
They are really interesting. Yeah, especially also because they didn't... They sort of horcruxed, if you'll let me use that as a verb, and in a way that probably doesn't really add up. But the idea that they sort of divested Rachel's... Because with every character... Well, with Jake, it's Cassie and Marco. With Cassie, it's Jake and Rachel. With Rachel, it's Tobias and Cassie. And then Marco, Tobias, and Axe, it's just sort of whatever.
They're to hang out and watch soap operas.
Yes, exactly. But so with Rachel, they sort of divested her emotional issues, which I one thing that I like about the romances in Animorphs is that, you know, A, they're young, so they're distracted by, like, war. So they're not, like, shallow or superficial or, like, overwrought. And at the same time, like, I feel like a lesser book would have given Tobias every part of Rachel's emotional arc in this book, whereas they split it between Tobias and Cassie, basically. And that a lot of the perception of value and wanting approval was sort of in Tobias's talons, if you will. But in terms of, like, you know, who was in danger that Rachel desperately wanted to save, like, who was the one that sort of was damseled a little bit, was Cassie. And the roles were very separate. Like, Cassie didn't really pass a lot of judgment on Rachel, and Rachel didn't feel a lot of judgment from Cassie, where in previous books maybe she would have, and instead that judgment was coming from Tobias. And then in previous books, like, Tobias has been damseled, and they actually reference it in the book when Tobias was, like, a willing prisoner of war in the Taylor, like, fiasco where they had the anti-morphing ray. Which I guess makes sense that a lot of the emotional issues that, like, are in this book with Rachel regarding Tobias are emotional fallout from that situation.
I think Horcrux is a very good verb.
Thank you.
Just in general, but also specifically for this. Because, it's a Rachel perspective book, and it might be the first Rachel perspective book we've had since the Rachel split book.
Ooh.
Is that true?
Let's find out.
Because reading her perspective in this one, I was like, God, I don't recall her being this angry. Like,
yeah.
I recall her being, like, you know, kind of snarky, but, you know, a little bit more chill. And she is very aggressive. Her narration of this is super aggressive, which makes sense. Because, you know, the war is starting to affect them, and she talks specifically about that. But, you know, in terms of a Horcrux, it is her soul that she's looking at in this book, and how it's reflected in Cassie, her best friend, how it's reflected in in the Bird Boy, who she doesn't ever say boyfriend. Although, sidebar, she does call Cassie Jake's girlfriend. So that was a big moment.
That is a big moment. We need to keep track of these things.
I was like, oh, damn, somebody said it. And even, like, even in Marco at the end, like, which is inevitably anything involving Marco is probably my favorite part of any book. But I thought their conversation was really good, and he's convincing her, like, that she needs to keep being the leader.
Yeah.
Because that was, like, the final piece of the Rachel Soul puzzle. That's where the final Horcrux is. It's in Marco.
Mm.
And then, actually, a little bit is, of course, of Jake, too, at the very end.
Well, Jake...
So, I'm coming down to the side of Horcrux.
Now that you have fleshed this out, I really like this. I think that this is part of why Rachel is always so much fun to talk about and also so tragic. But there's never, I feel like we're never lacking things to talk about with Rachel because there's always so much there. And I feel like as we've, her tracking her is always really rewarding. Not necessarily because it feels good, because it doesn't, but it's just very, it's there. Like, it is written and in all of her narrations that she is losing her soul to this war, and she's aware of it, and then also not at the same time. She's aware of it, and then she does really stupid shit to, like, ignore the fact that she's aware of it, which makes her seem like she's unaware of it, and you're like, oh no, honey.
The hubris monologue in this I thought was interesting. There's actually a couple of fun, like
literary
classic
references.
Literature,
yeah.
References. The classic Marco Hamlet complex.
Yeah.
Which is a line that I didn't really understand when I was a kid, obviously, because I haven't read Hamlet yet,
mm-hmm.
but which stuck with me. When I read it again, I was like, yes, Marco does have a Hamlet complex. And then, no, Rachel's like going off on Oedipus Rex and like, what grade are they in? They're reading Oedipus Rex in middle school. Her whole thing where that's very self-aware, but also then she just keeps doing it. Like, girl.
Yeah. No, that's a very salient, like, which, I mean, if, like, you know, if they're throwing in literary references, you know that they're, like, for good reason. It's not just, like, when they mention, like, you know. Exactly. I was trying to think of a topical time, like, a time-appropriate reference, but all I could think of were the ones that, like, could be any time. Like, I think they reference like, Beyonce or J-Lo, and I'm like, well, those people still are topical. I just couldn't get, like, a dated reference. But yeah, I feel like Rachel, in any given book, there's also always an element of foreshadowing a little bit. Which always, now that I think about this, and presumably, if you are listening to this, that this too is a great Animorphs reread for you, and so you know what happens in the end. If you don't, stop now, or fast forward a little bit. But if you know what happens, and, like, presumably, when you go back and read it, it's impossible not to remember what happens and not to always have that in your mind when you're reading Rachel narration, because, I don't know about y'all, but, like, the demise of Rachel was, like, very influential, literary moment in my, like, early adolescence. And I feel like shades of inevitability are in this book, and I actually would wonder, K.A., if you're listening, give us a sign somehow. Tell us when you decided that, like, this book series would end with Rachel sacrificing herself, because now reading it, it seems like it's the only, it's awfully fatalistic to say it's the only possible outcome, but there's a lot of foreshadowing for it, and it always, and it seems like, of course that's what happens. Of course that's what Rachel does. Like, it seems like everything is hurtling towards that, given her narration and given how she's starting to handle situations and how she's, like, super arrogant but also, like, self-punishing.
That's a good summation, those two adjectives. And after I finished reading it, I lay there in my bed thinking about it, of course. And it seems like particular those two flavors seem really to be, you know, the things that make her, if you blend them, that's what you get. You get Rachel, because this book is about her trying to fill in for Jake. He's not here. She's in the leadership position. And her monologue at the beginning about Oedipus Rex and about Greek hubris and what happens to people who indulge in it is like, that's not her role. She's not their leader. And this book kind of proves that she isn't, and she can't be, and she shouldn't be. And it, at the end, even she's, you know, more than willing to admit that, and she's really happy to see Jake. And she literally says, "Don't go away again. Like, you can't leave. Don't do this. It was a mistake. It was a huge mistake."
Mm.
And so you have this whole book of her trying to fill a role that isn't hers, that she, on some level, wants to be. Because when they have the initial discussion of, like, who should carry out this mission in Jake's absence, you know, oh, it's me. Of course it's going to be me. Like, who else would it be? It's going to be Rachel.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to read that and to not think about the David book, which, when are we not thinking about the David books?
Never. It's always on our mind.
About the David books. Because it's not the first time that you see her in what her role is, but it's the first time anybody named Jake is super overt about it. I mean, like, yeah, you're my weapon. I'm going to deploy you as I see fit.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to read her as, you know, doing anything but reacting against that, against not wanting to be that,
mm-hmm.
to thinking she can do something else and be something else, be a different part of the team.
And then
she can't.
Oh, man.
Ultimately, she can't. It's like, oh, my God.
Oh, I feel so terrible. It's so good, though. It's so, like, well-constructed. Yeah, the idea that... And that's the thing, like, she's completely aware of
Have that sense of, like, she's watching herself and she's, like, horrified, like, by, like, the bad decisions that she's making or that Cassie gets captured because she made a stupid call. But she can't, like, not do that.
Yeah. She goes into a situation, guns blazing. They need that. They absolutely need that. Because if you imagine, I mean, yes, it's true that Rachel is not the right leader for the Animorphs. But if you imagine if this book had been Cassie taking Jake's place, or Marco, or Tobias, things wouldn't have gotten done. So... And
that's part of why I liked Marco's, at the end, his conversation with her. Like, he's not her best friend, he's not her cousin, he's not her boyfriend, but, like, he was the only one who could have talked her back into doing what needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it really effectively, because he's Marco.
Because he yelled at
him. And, like, I maybe she was chosen him to begin with, but he's not the person they need now.
No.
He's not going to crash a jet. Like, I forget that happened, and I'm like, oh, they stole a jet because of, wait, they crashed the jet?
Yeah. When they were stealing the jet, I was like, wait, they're human right now? Like, it's insanity, and it's perfect because it's Rachel. And I also feel like, again, Rachel's recklessness in that situation was part of self-punishment, was part of, like, carrying the burden so that other people don't have to carry the burden.
Yeah, it's very, like, self-immolation.
And this case, yeah, and she, and in this case, she created a situation where she earned it. She earned her burden. But if you think about, again, fast-forwarding to the end of the series, like, the concept of sacrifice, like, that's the way for Rachel, is to be the one that carries the burden. And that's how Jake deploys her as a weapon, is, like, that's a burden. That's a weight. That, like, Rachel doesn't want Cassie to carry, or Tobias to carry, or even Marco to carry, really. Definitely not Jake. Like, because Jake's got a burden of his own, which they reference in the end. I do think the most important conversations in this book were between Marco in relation to leadership, and then between Jake and Rachel in relation to leadership. It's interesting to imagine how the situation would have played out if Jake were there. So just a real quick synopsis, now that we've been talking about this anyways, endlessly, is that because this inspector is here, Rachel has this idea that they should make Visser 3 look bad to the inspector so that, like, they'll get rid of him, and then it might be, like, then an evil even worse or whatever, but that this is too good of an opportunity to, like, sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Exploit? Like, Mr. Three's weaknesses in this area. And so they are reluctant to do it in general. And then Rachel's idea is also kind of new territory for them, where, like, it's basically, like, terrorizing the public in their animorphs, like, morphs, and trying to pick places that have a high, like, controller presence and hopefully don't hurt any innocent bystanders in the process. And to go in for, like, 5 minutes, destroy shit, and then move on to the next place to do the exact same thing. And, like, Rachel loves it, like, a little too much. Everyone else is not so sure because they don't really stake any place out. They don't necessarily get all the information about, like, the exits and, like, what sort of situation, what sort of challenges they might encounter. Rachel's literally just like, I'm a bear. I'm gonna kick the door in. I'm gonna slap some people around and make a big mess. And that's all you need to know. I'll go out the way I came in. There's a hole there.
I'm sure this didn't bother me when I was a kid, but now that I'm an adult, I'm reading this and going, this is such a mess.
Yeah.
Those poor people, they have to clean everything up. They're probably, like, get in trouble from, like, their corporate office.
Well,
all this destroyed merchandise.
Well, that's also the thing is, well, the idea, like, reading this, between crashing a jet into a building and, like, terrorizing public spaces with violence, like, the fact that this book was written in 2000 and the fact that we read it when we were children means definitely something different than reading it now, with all of the events of the world under our belts where we're just like, ah.
Yes, this is a pre-9/11 book.
Yeah, needless to say. So yeah, so it's interesting to contemplate what the plans would have been if Jake were there. And I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility to assume that the same things would have happened, but they would have been filtered through Jake's even hand, and therefore there would have been a little more precaution. But I don't think that a lot of things would be different. Maybe the end. Maybe the last one. That's the big one. But I think everything up until then would probably be something similar.
Yeah. I mean, the major, I feel like the major deviances in Rachel's leadership style are in terms of, yeah, planning. The fact that they don't stake anything out, they don't infiltrate, like, certain spaces. And then, of course, the polar bear morph. I don't think Jake would have done that.
Yeah.
He would have probably been like, no, standard battle morphs, like, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Not all gonna be polar bears.
Well, yeah, no, that's, Rachel is, like, showy. Rachel is showy. Rachel has, like, she wants to make
and, like,
the biggest,
oops.
She wants to scare the shit out of everyone. Like, dial it to 11 and, like, keep it there.
The weird thing with the polar bears is that I feel like they should have learned their lesson with the cheetahs. Because the initial cheetah morph, like, they use it because it's really fast and the Garatron is really fast. Like, even his thoughts speak as fast, which is kind of hard to read.
It was.
I'm just getting old.
I need mind breaks, you guys.
Like, what did he say? I know he's being mean, but what? But then the cheetahs tire out really, they're not endurance animals. They tire out really quickly, and then it's like, all right, it's just a big cat at that point.
Fitting.
Like, if you get close enough, it'll probably swipe you with its paws, but it can't run anymore. And therefore, its thing is no longer useful. And it's the same with the polar bear. It's like, yeah, a polar bear is terrifying, and it can really hurt you, you know, with its claws, and it's bulky and, like, difficult to stop, but it has a very significant weakness, which is heat, of course, because blubber and insulation in terms of fur. And so it's like, yeah, once, at that point, the switch is flipped, and it is no longer useful at all.
Yeah. Well, and another thing that is,
variety, guys, it's the spice of life.
Well, the thing also that really differentiates Jake and Rachel is that Jake deploys, like, the strengths of each of the people in the group. So, like, if Cassie had had a say, she probably would have been like, hey, I know animals. Here are the strengths. Here are the weaknesses. Although she did suggest cheetahs in the first place. But more to the point, Rachel is a terrible listener. Like, terrible listener. People say things to her and then she ignores them and just does whatever the hell she wants anyways. Which does not, like, that's how mutiny happens, Rachel. That's why everyone wanted to kill you. Because
yeah.
You didn't listen to people.
People, like, think they have some input. Especially
yeah.
when it's life or death.
Mm-hmm.
Her leadership style is definitely, even the way she thinks about it, like, is very different from what we've seen Jake think in his internal monologue about what, like, being a leader means. She says, like, specifically, like, oh, people want, or they don't want a leader that's, like, human. And then Axe later specifically says, like, well, this is a mistake that was made, and as much as we might like leaders to be perfect, they're not, so we'll just deal with it and move on. Like, well, Axe, aren't you mature?
Yeah.
Probably because you come from a very bureaucratic society. But so do humans.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
and
this...
so, like, yeah, reading what she thinks a leader is supposed to be versus what everybody else thinks a leader is supposed to be, either from what they say outright or from what we know from having read Jake's perspective on his position, is just, like, it's kind of heartbreaking. Like, where did you get these ideas from, baby?
Yeah.
Does that reflect in reality?
This idea of, like, imperviousness, and she repeatedly uses the phrases, like, hero, warrior, king, which I adore that they make a point to, like, not, like, I guess, I mean, it is gendered, but that it's, like, Rachel is still like, yeah, I'm gonna be a king. Like, try and stop
it's really
me.
Like Macbeth.
Yeah. Nice. More literary references. Very nice.
Well, that, like, you know, once she started repeating that, and I was like, oh, she doesn't say queens, like, she's not thinking about queens.
Mm-mm.
And then Parker started talking about Hamlet, and I was like, this reminds me of Lady Macbeth and, like, the unsex me monologue.
Mm.
The idea that, like, you cannot be effectively brutal with your female.
Ooh. Well, and part of that is, I mean, that's part of Rachel's... And we've talked about, like, you know, Buffy and stuff like that in this thing. Or if you're blonde and conventionally attractive, like white lady, then it's like, oh, like, you are not to be taken seriously, and that Rachel then will kill you. And then you realize, oh, I should have taken her seriously. She has anger issues.
Too late from 6 feet under.
Exactly. Like, she has anger issues, and it was and a, like a happy trigger finger, as it were. Yeah. Yeah, and again, and so much, and being, like you said, like, showy and the risk-taking of when they needed that, when Cassie was captured, of, like, they steal a jet as humans, then they crash the jet, and, like, Rachel is last to leave the jet and, like, morphs mid-air, plummeting to the ground, like, and then, the plan is basically to go in and just, like, wing it, no pun intended. Like, and I did really love, for as much as, like, Cassie was not judgmental or didn't really get sort of sanctimonious with Rachel, I did really enjoy when Rachel, like, landed. Let's see if I can find it. They reunited, and Rachel said, "Surprised to see me?" And then Cassie said, "Sky falling in, flames everywhere, Yurt's running for cover. Who else would it be but you?"
Aww. It's very sweet.
It is.
Sweet.
It is, in a weird way. And there's still something, like, so charming about Rachel. And obviously, like, yeah, we know that they need her. And that was another thing that, like... I mean, Cassie and Marco told Jake about what happened, and I suspect that they... did not beat around the bush. I suspect that Cassie was more tactful. But I imagine that they didn't gloss over things, and that Jake knows full well what happened, and also that Jake could imagine what would happen.
Also, he saw it on the news. Like, they were on the news, obviously, because they were running around in downtown in, like, a shopping center, just, like, fucking shit up. And so, yeah, that's, like, the best line that's ever been written, is... Jake comes home from his vacation, which, sidebar, is just really weird to think about any of these kids, like, just going to see their cousins or whatever.
Yeah.
And he's like, Yeah, someone in the news. And he says something about how, like, it involved some people he knew. Like, yeah, kind of.
Well, that was, but that was, like, so wonderful because Jake didn't, like, throw the book at her and, like, didn't get as sanctimonious as, like, a lot of the others did in his absence, like, holding her to his standard. And then he was like, it's really hard. No one died. I think you're fine. Which is what Rachel needed to hear. And I think, like, a nice way to sort of, not absolve Rachel, but sort of lessen the blow of the fact that she is who she is. And that, you know, an old man died because of her in this book. And that, like, really terrified her and upset her retroactively. She, like, didn't really have the, like, forethought to be like, an old man might die. But after it happened, was like, oh shit, I feel like the worst person on the planet. Again, like, being arrogant on the front end, and then, like, being consumed with self-punishment on the back end. And, like, she found the grandkid, who doesn't, like, know her from Adam, and doesn't know what she has to do with anything, but she's still there, like, I'm so sorry about what happened, and he's like, alright.
His mom's like, why are you here again? Did we know you?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just another piece of the Rachel as not leader puzzle is that, I mean, Jake is, like, pretty much constantly, like, feeling horrible, but he has more of a capacity, apparently, to keep moving, whereas, you know, yeah, in the moment, Rachel's, like, smash everything up, loud and reckless, like, let's go. And then after the fact is just, like, immobilized by, like, all the mistakes that she made. Which, to be fair, is probably exactly what I would do, because I have a hard time getting over anything in my life, ever. But it's because, you know, I would not be the leader in this situation. Yeah, that's another thing that I think makes her less suited than Jake.
Well, and that's sort of, like, we kind of talk about how Rachel doesn't have the luxury of not being the weapon, of not being the bullet or the gun, or however you want to phrase that metaphor. But on the flip side, Jake doesn't have the luxury of ultimately not feeling responsible. Jake is the, not the puppet master, but, I mean, he's calling the shots, and so ultimately everything comes back to him. And he's good at it, and he does it in a way where he's not just making decisions necessarily in the way that Rachel was. That they're all sort of complicit in the decisions that are made. But that Jake has to, like, compartmentalize in order to be able to move forward. And that is why he's, like, never the same and is not, like, a functional human when this is all said and done. Which also makes you wonder, like, if Rachel had survived, would she have been a functional human? And as I ask that question, I'm shaking my head no. Like, I did not even finish the question, was already answering it with body language. Like, there was no way. And she would be way, like, Jake just sort of numbs out. Like, Jake just sort of becomes a zombie. But, like, Rachel would probably have become, like, self-destructive. Like, Rachel probably would have been way more external and, like, explosively falling apart and, like, not being. Like, she would have started, like, thrill-seeking and then, like, not know how to, like, demonstrate love for people in her life. And, like, it would have been bad. It would have been bad.
Yeah, that's been as a kind of a constant Rachel theme, is that everybody, like, thinks this about her, which is probably pretty rough to know that your friends think this about you. That, not that the war is, like, a good thing, but that it makes sense that she's reacted to it the way that she has, and that it, like, basically gave her an outlet.
Mm.
And that otherwise she, you know, yeah, she would have, something would have happened at some point in her life if this hadn't happened.
Yeah. The idea that, like, she became the person she was meant to be because of the situation. And you can't say that about Jake, and you can't say that about Marco or Cassie. You could kind of say that about Tobias. The identity that he has gained from this situation is that he learned where his, like, who his real parents were and, like, where he really came from, which is valuable, but that's really irrelevant to the war. That's, like, a positive thing that he can always sort of, I guess, sort of say as a silver lining or hold on to that, despite the fact that everything else about the situation is real shitty. Especially considering what he loses in the end as well. I just had, like, the mental image of him flying away with Rachel's urn, and then, like, it's way too much. I had forgotten about that until the very moment when I thought about, like, the idea that Tobias thinking, like, I take it all back. I don't think he would ever think that, like, finding his family was, like, a silver lining, given what ended up happening anyways. Like, ugh, I'm sad now.
I read some good Jake meta on Tumblr.
Oh, I think I saw that also.
About, like, him prior to the war, and what you said about how the war is the only person that it really properly alchemized, I guess, is Rachel. Because, like, yeah, prior to that, Jake's just a kid. Like, you know, he's not particularly good at video games or basketball, and that's kind of all we have.
Yeah.
He's not, like, super smart, he's not super athletic, he's not, like, super, he's not a superhero. And there's nothing to indicate that his life would have been anything but really normal.
Yeah.
Or that he wanted it to be anything but, like, really normal.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
And I appreciated not only sort of the interpretation that way, but also that it was written that way in the first place. Because nothing's worse than, like, a white boy leader that, like, something's, like, special about him or something's, like, unique.
Yeah.
Or, like, he's, like...
We got enough, like... chosen. And, you know, similarly, Harry Potter is not, I mean, yes, Harry Potter is a chosen one, like,
mm-hmm.
all caps, but he's also pretty ordinary at the beginning.
Yeah.
And even throughout, like, he's still not the smartest, or, you know, the most whatever, necessarily.
Yeah.
He just makes good decisions.
That
is nice. Sometimes. He tells himself people who are good at things.
Exactly.
Which is also what Jake does.
That is also true. It's
smart. Blessed in his friends.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, you know, coming from, obviously, I'm not in the military and I never fought in a war, and most of my stakes are extremely low ones, but I have a job and, you know, I've had bosses, all kinds of bosses, and the best leaders are the ones who know what to do with their underlings.
Yeah.
That's my thesis on leadership.
I think we just circled back around to, like, the bureaucracy of, like, office politics and stuff like that. So I think we just came full circle on this, Jack. I really appreciate it. I think we did it.
I will say that, like, Rachel's leadership style is kind of like Wizard 3's. I mean, you know... She's interesting foil for Wizard 3 in this book. I don't know if that really scans across the entire series,
sure.
necessarily, because she's not usually in a leadership position, but...
Flashy.
Maybe it balances with it. Like, she's loud and flashy, and she goes for scary stuff. Like, what is his morph even at the end? I couldn't really parse what he turned into.
It's
other than it was
puddle
just, like,
of flanker.
It literally it's like the thing. It was, like, crushing to death? Like, I don't know what's happening.
And it, like, smelled really badly.
Oh,
like garbage
yeah.
and corpses. And then he was like, I know. I'll just stink the place up.
A morph for every occasion.
Yeah. That is maybe the one area, and especially, you know, compared to the last book where we sort of had a lot of ways in which we thought it could be improved. In this book, not so much. But I guess maybe one area would be in potentially fleshing out a little bit, like a comparison, kind of drawing parallels between Visser 3's leadership style and Rachel's. I don't know that it would need to be, like, a big thing, though, because I kind of like that it's not a big thing. And obviously evidence is there. She crashes a plane into a, like, roof of a building, so it's not, like, that much of a stretch.
She also doesn't take a direction well.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, Visser 3 does not really listen to the people who are under him. And I wouldn't say that Rachel, like, rules with terror, necessarily, or is, like, a dictator, but, you know, if something really happened to Jake and they had to choose a new leader, and for some reason they chose her, then, yeah, it would probably develop pretty quickly.
Well, it's like the cheetah.
The, like, tin pot dictator.
Yeah, like, it would, there would not be any endurance to, like, keep this, like, situation going. It's good for, like, Rachel's tactics are good for hard and fast, like, insane rescue missions, that need to be done on a fast deadline and not for anything that requires long-term planning. Which, again, is sort of, like, that was an element, to answer your question from earlier, this is the first book of Rachel since the split. And that was something that was a notable difference between evil Rachel and nice Rachel,
yeah,
was that evil
Rachel did not have any kind of, like, forethought.
No, like, no ability to plan for the future. And it's, you wonder if Rachel can look that far into the future, given the way that this war is changing her and the person that she's becoming. And then also, like, thinking about the inevitability of, you know, from an authorial standpoint, I don't think that's a word, but from the, like, the idea of, like, if you have to pick the end for Rachel, can you imagine, like, well into the future for Rachel? Like, it really is, it the way it ended, it was how it kind of had to end. And like what you said earlier, that it's got to be rough for, like, you to, and again, the self-awareness, for Rachel to be aware that her friends think of her how they do, and the idea that, like, she's scary sometimes. And I think that there's an element of fear, especially from Cassie, of, like, losing her, or going so far in other opposite directions that, like, this war has spun Rachel in one direction and Cassie in the other, and that there's never going to be, like, a place for them to, like, meet again. And again, all very sad.
Well, I mean, I know that technically Rachel is back together again with herself in this book. Like, obviously they smashed the two halves together in the previous Rachel book. But you can definitely see Wimpy Rachel, and I forget how they refer to her other half in that book. We'll just call her Bonkers Rachel. Because she is. Because, yeah, Bonkers Rachel, loud and scary and violent and can't plan. And then Wimpy Rachel, like, her fatal flaw was that, like, she overthought everything, and she thought too much.
Yeah.
And so in this book, it's like, yes, there's only one Rachel now. And Bonkers Rachel is displayed, you know, when she makes these bad morph calls, or, you know, is not capable of, like, doing, you know, some surveillance work before just going into a place. But then all the aftermath is her weak, air quote,
yeah,
half of getting caught up on everything that went wrong and overthinking it in hindsight.
Yeah, and the self-punishing thing. And the other thing also that I noticed is that she has ridiculously high standards for herself. Where, like, when Jake comes back, she's like, yeah, but I didn't kill Visser 3. And Jake was like, what the hell?
Like, he was like, I didn't tell you to kill Visser 3. Like, what are you even talking about?
Like, we're 37 books in.
Nobody expected you to check that box while I was on vacation.
Exactly. Like, that's an absurd standard. But that was, like, what she had in her head was that, like, she was going to hand his ass to him on, like, a platter. And, like, and they, like, try to assassinate him in the first 20 pages, which stressed me out, BT dubs, because for as much as the last book was, like, kind of a slow burn, but where things happened quickly, and then you were like, what's going to happen the rest of this book? This book was really fast in that, yeah, they try and assassinate Visser 3 in, like, the first 20 pages, and then you're like, what is this book going to do? Like, I can't, this book is at full throttle, like, the whole time, which is fitting, based on what we've said about Rachel, but it made for a little bit of a stressful read, in a good way. One last thought, again, comparing to Visser 3 and Rachel, you can sort of also look at, like, the evaluation of Visser 3 in this book from the Garatron, and it's basically, like, evaluating Visser 3's effectiveness as a leader, and Rachel is under scrutiny also for her leadership skills, which are similar, as you have noticed. Yeah, the idea that, like, she in a way is also being evaluated, just, you know, for this one brief circumstance where she's in charge. And
I gotta say, I mean, the actual nitty-gritty bad planning parts of this plan aside, I don't think it's a good plan.
Okay.
I would not have voted for this plan.
No? Tell me why.
We discussed it a little bit. I think Tobias says it, that, like, you know, better the evil you know, or whatever. If the Garatron Inspector is there specifically to take notes on why Visitor is bad at his job, to the end of theoretically getting him replaced with somebody who is more efficient, because efficiency in all things, capitalism, even your capitalism, you don't want somebody who's better at their job of invading a planet.
That is true. That is a very good point.
What is the absolute worst?
I mean, you're not wrong. I feel like it's pretty easy to be like, yeah, you know what? I don't want somebody who's more efficient at taking over the planet when I am trying to stop them from taking over the planet. Like, yeah.
I mean, I guess if they had some proven idea of, like, what would happen if Mr. 3 were replaced,
yeah,
like, there would be some kind of power vacuum, but that wouldn't really, that probably wouldn't happen because they've got faster than light travel. Like, it wouldn't take a while for whoever the replacement is to arrive.
Yeah.
And if it's the Garatron, then he's already there.
Yeah.
But yeah, they don't have any proof of what it would be like, and you can't assume that whoever they send as a replacement wouldn't just get it done immediately.
Yeah. So who, I feel like this is our last question, who would you have voted to be leader?
Marco.
Yeah, me too, probably.
Marco has already proven that he's good at planning things, including, and up to, trying to assassinate his own mother. Like, come
yeah.
on. He's the guy you want.
Yeah, it's true.
If Jake isn't there.
It's hard to argue with that. Well, and there's also something to be said for, like, Marco's role in the group doesn't change that much if he becomes leader. Whereas Cassie's role changes if she becomes leader, and it affects her leadership. Rachel's role, obviously, changes when she becomes leader, and it affects her leadership. Tobias, maybe not. I don't know. He's usually sort of the eyes and ears, and I feel like
just by dint of him having to be his hawk self most of the time,
mm-hmm.
he is not because he can't or would have, like, bad planning skills or wouldn't be able to make decisions on the fly, but just because of, like, simple mobility issues, like, sometimes he's going to have to be a hawk.
Yeah.
May or may not be helpful in terms of hijacking a plane.
Yeah.
Just for example.
That is, just off the cuff. No, that is a good point also. And then Axe, of course, is, like, not gonna step up. Like, and because Axe's role is also just, like, providing knowledge and, like, skill and know-how. And so that's not necessarily something that's gonna translate well into leadership. Whereas Marco, his skills as his role in the group, if he becomes leader, there's not a downside to that, really. There's not a, like, a big shift in his role that would affect the overall outcome of losing, like, the orchestrator. It'd be annoying, though, because all of the meetings would involve, like, he would try and bring up topics about, like, Baywatch or something, like, to get people
yeah,
to
like, I started thinking, you know, when the initial question of who should lead in Jake's absence comes up and they're trying to decide and, like, vote on it, and, of course, inevitably the reader is like, well, who would I choose? And I go for Marco, and then I started thinking about, like, why isn't Marco the leader?
Mm.
Is it just because he's really annoying? Because, I mean, yeah, he's fairly cunning.
Mm.
He can be, like, really brutal when necessary. He knows all of the other team members very well, like, well enough that you can imagine him, you know, pulling their strings the way that Jake does.
I don't think he's
convincing in terms of arguments, usually. He's very good at, like, pushing people's buttons, which, if he could rein that in, that would probably be necessary. You know, it would be something he'd have to use judiciously if he were the leader.
Yeah.
So yeah, I have to assume that the reason he's not is because he is fucking obnoxious.
I think that definitely Marco's probably too annoying. I don't think he inspires feelings of, like, collaboration in others.
I think he's not super interested in, like, smoothing the path necessarily.
Yeah, he's maybe a little too blunt. I think people also would maybe not respond to, I don't know, that maybe he's, like, too cunning. That, like, maybe that Jake can get away with manipulating people because he's more unassuming and more kind of bland than Marco, who is a little more like strategic and whip smart and also will talk your ear off while he's doing it, and you're just like, this is a lot of person right now.
He's a lot.
Marco would not, I mean, like, Marco's also kind of fundamentally lazy, so.
It's true, I definitely think he wants to be the leader. No. I've never gotten the sense from, like, his perspective books that he's envious of Jake's position. I usually feel like he pities him.
Mm-hmm.
Or not pities, but he does not want to be that guy.
And he doesn't have the moral compass? And I don't mean that in, like, a bad way about him, but, like, I feel like if any of the Animorphs were likely to walk away and not be tortured about it, I would be him.
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of talked about this before, and the who would win the Hunger Games scenario. And it's him for the same reasons.
Well, I feel like we've sufficiently exhausted all of the material in this book, and I'm excited that we did so. What's next? I think it's an Axe book. When I read the preview, there was a lot of talk about cinnamon buns. Number 38, The Arrival.
Just when we get more Animorphs? Or more Andalites?
Maybe. That sounds about right.
Does that mean the Axe gets to kiss?
This is also, we should just let everyone know that we're on the pivot point of Y2K. The Weakness was published in December of 99. And this next book, The Arrival, is January 2000. So we're about to read our first Animorphs book of the new millennium. It's very exciting.
I wonder if there'll be a light. I can't remember if there have been any Y2K references in the books. I mean, that was definitely a thing people
mm-hmm.
talked about.
So thank you for joining us for number 38. Nope, 37. The Weakness. And we will be back soon to discuss 38, The Arrival, as we embark on the new century 17 years later. Until then, happy trails.